I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to You're On Mute, a new podcast series conceived by BBI, the UK's first Black business institute, an organisation which aims to boost prospects for underprivileged Black entrepreneurs by promoting equivalent access to the UK's funding structures and essential business networks. I'm your host, entrepreneur and business mentor, Bianca Miller-Cole, and over the next 12 weeks, myself and my fellow hosts, June Sarpong and Lord Michael Hastings will be interviewing an incredible lineup of leaders, icons, and changemakers to ascertain how they balance the importance of commercial performance versus societal impact. As we all know, with great power comes huge responsibility, and this series looks at how those in positions of influence can use their status as a force for good. Our time together is broken down into three sections, with the guests sharing their favourite pieces of music or soundtrack representing a memorable stage of their life. Joining me today is Patrick Hutchinson, GQ's Humanitarian of the Year, BLM hero, author, co-founder of UTC AI, and now online coach. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's genuinely a pleasure to meet you. Now, as I mentioned, the podcast is going to be broken down into three segments with your choice of music preceding each one. So your first choice was Biggie Smalls' Machine Gun Funk. What memories does that conjure up for you?
Well, the music I listened to when I was a young man growing up was mainly sort of hip hop music. I did have a very conscious side to me. Like I liked some artists that, you know, rapped about conscious things. But then there was obviously the other side where a lot of the rap was about the upbringing of these artists, what they'd been through, you know, some stuff that they would do, you know, like selling drugs, for example, that people might frown upon, but this was their lives and they rapped about it. And so, you know, Biggie Smalls, as we know, is no longer with us. He's one of the artists that I sort of hold close to my heart. I loved a lot of his music, and Machine Gun Funk was the track that really had me going whenever his music was played.
Okay, I love that. So growing up, I know we know you now for your kind of meteoric rise and your plethora of accolades, and you know your name is very well known now, but I'd love to know a little bit more about you as you were growing up. So I understand you're one of eight siblings. You grew up in Wandsworth and you're raised by your mother. So what was that like?
Yeah, so when I say one of eight siblings, that's on my father's side. On my mother's side, there was just two of us, my sister and I, and my mother. And I met my other eight siblings a little later on down the line. So, you know, growing up from the early ages, it was just my sister and my mom, just the three of us. But it was, you know, I had a good upbringing. I did feel quite lonely at times because, like I say, it was only my mum and my sister, and then I had a series of aunts and stuff, so I didn't have that many male role models in my life until my uncle came down from Coventry to live with us for a little bit, and my uncle being my mother's younger brother, Coventry being a bit at the time not much going on there, so she helped him come down to London and sort of settle and establish himself, and in the process he stayed at our house, and you know, I looked up to him. He was like a father figure to me. I tried to follow him everywhere, but you know, eventually, as things happen with families, him and my mum, you know, they had to go their separate ways. Him being a young man, my mum being an older woman, and he was getting up to a little bit of some naughty stuff, and she couldn't have him in the house anymore to influence me. You know, so unfortunately, that relationship broke away. But I played out a lot, had lots of many friends. I lived on a council estate. I had, you know, a black and white friends, but I think on my estate was mainly white friends. And I suffered, you know, sometimes the indignity of racism. I didn't quite understand it at the time, what was happening. But as I got older, I began to realize why people would say certain things to me and about me. Mm-hmm. I had a quite a good upbringing.
Would you say that while you were growing up, obviously you were, as you said, you're surrounded by different ethnicities and different people. Did you need a role model growing up? And if so, who was that role model?
Definitely feel like having a role model, especially when, you know, for me as a young black boy, I definitely felt like I needed, you know, people to aspire to and to look up to. Outside of my uncle and one of my mum's partners, Oliver, who was around for a particular period of time, they were the only two men I knew. But sort of more out there in the public spotlight, I loved Muhammad Ali. I loved Bruce Lee was probably one of my number one, role models I looked up to because I was into martial arts from an early age. I also liked Pelé, the footballer. There was Jack Johnson, who I read a lot about growing up, who was the first black heavyweight champion of the world and a very, very controversial character back in the early 1900s during the Jim Crow era. So these are the people that I looked up to.
Were you also academic? I know, because, you know, sometimes you have that influence from your parents encouraging you to embrace academia. Was that something that you did embrace?
I didn't love to, but I did because my mother, you know, wanted me to. She didn't get an opportunity to, educationally. She spent a lot of her time looking after her brothers and sisters. And so in doing so, she missed out on her education for herself. So she wanted to make sure my sister and I, you know, had a really good education, and she sent us to good schools. I don't even know how she pulled it off now that I'm a parent myself and had to attempt to get my children into good schools. I don't know how she managed to do it, but she did. She got us into both good schools. And I did, I was an average student with the potential of, you know, going further. But I think sometimes the company I kept kept me sort of back a bit. But generally speaking, I did, you know, I got O-levels, which is what I did back in the day. I got six of them, which is not bad going. And I went on to college.
You know, I think that's such an important story because it can be so easy to just focus on sport or your natural instinct to be good at martial arts and so on, but to embrace academia at the same time and find that balance. Often, I'm sure, because your mum pushed you to, but that's really good. I think that's important. Patrick, you mentioned briefly that you had experienced racism. What was that like?
I did experience racism at an early age. And I didn't really quite understand it at first. But then as I got older, I realized what was happening. It didn't affect me hugely. I don't know why. That's probably quite a sad thing, really, because I think I maybe got used to it. Probably not the best thing to say, but I think I did. I think I got so used to the name calling. It just became, you know, sort of almost like water off a duck's back. And even on TV, we would watch TV back in the day, and you'd have your Ralph Garnetts of the world saying, you know, lots of derogatory things, and it was all acceptable back then. So I guess it's the environment you grow up with. Nowadays, it's all covert. It's not as overt as it was back then. It's all, the hidden stuff. It's all the unconscious bias and the things that are, you know, embedded within our society. I haven't experienced overt racism as an adult, to be honest. I don't know, maybe it's probably the way I look.
I mean, that's potentially more scary, isn't it? The fact that it's not so overt, that it's so discreet.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, because it can't be easy to reflect back on those experiences and to realize that actually at the time you maybe weren't equipped to deal with it. It was just, you were just absorbing it into your kind of subconscious. Yeah. All right, well, we're on now section two. So I'm going to introduce your next track. So your next track was Patrice Rushen, Forget Me Nots. Was it very different to your first one? What was it that made you choose that track?
The genres of music that I listen to are quite wide, and, it was quite difficult to pick the tracks because I like so much music and different types of music. But the go-to music that I always really, really loved throughout growing up, there was like the rare groove and soul music, and hip hop music. Those are the two sort of stalwarts. I really loved sort of 70s and 80s soul music growing up.
And does that song for you represent that change in your life from being a youth to going into the world of employment?
Yeah, it does. It represents me sort of growing up a bit. And it also, it seemed to just appear at various points in my life, life-changing, you know, moments in my life, that song. So then it began to just stick with me. Then I delved a little bit more into the artist and I realized that, you know, I liked a lot of her music. So yeah, that's my track, man. And it holds lots of memories, fond memories with me, you know, growing up, particular girlfriends and, you know, when one of my children were born, et cetera, et cetera. So it's always sort of there ringing in my ears.
So when you left school and you entered the world of employment, what was your ambition?
So, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I was always a sporty child and I really wanted to play football or do something along those lines, but my mum was adamant. So after leaving school, I did a computer science course, a BTEC course at college. And the plan was to then go on and go to university, probably Warwick, because I was from Coventry originally, and do a computer science degree. And the course that I did would have got me sort of onto the second year. I wouldn't have had to do the first year. I would have gone on to the second year. But my son was born, and that sort of put a spanner in the works. I realized I need to get a job and fast. And so the course I did, the computer science BTEC National Diploma, I think it was called, that got me straight into a job in the city. And then that's where I began my 23-year stint within the corporate industry, working for various different investment banks in IT.
And what did it feel like as a, you know, boy from Wandsworth, humble background and beginnings, going into some of the globe's most important financial centres in the City of London?
It was quite daunting at first because there weren't too many, you know, young black boys working in the city at that time. There were some, but, you know, there wasn't lots of us. And luckily for me, the person that trained me up, a guy named Andrew, who's still a good friend of mine, he was also black. You know, he made me feel at home. And if he could do it, I could do it. It was a bit of a wake up call as to like you have one world and then you're thrusted into another world and you realize, wow. And then you get to see how the other half live a bit. I worked very closely with traders and people that were making lots and lots of money. And, you know, I'm coming from a council estate in Battersea and Wandsworth. And now I'm rubbing shoulders with traders and millionaires, basically. And it was definitely a time to reflect on, like, wow, this is what you can do if you educate yourself or if you, you know, you're lucky enough to you know, be thrusted in a particular position or whatever the case may be. This is what you can do. So, yeah, it kind of opened my eyes and made me realize, you know, I need to knuckle down and you know, make some money while I'm here.
Did you see any kind of disparities in the way that black staff were treated in these organizations?
In the early days, I didn't, because I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't clued up in that type of stuff. Again, it was probably like sort of going over my head, a bit oblivious to it all. But as I got older and wiser and realized certain things started to affect me, then I started to delve a little bit deeper and look into things and then realize, okay, yeah, there are things sort of going on here untoward, you know, beneath the surface. And then also when you start to talk to other people that look like you, you realize it's not you know, you're not the only one that's going through this. There are others who are going through exactly the same thing that you are, you know, experiencing the glass ceiling where they're not able to sort of get to that next level, pay disparities, because I found out on many occasions about the, you know, me earning a lot less money and through talking to colleagues. So yeah, as you get older and wiser, you start to realize what's really going on.
With 23 years in that industry, did you see some changes over that time in terms of disparities, diversity, inclusion challenges?
The only change that really I would say that I saw was the numbers. So in terms of you know, the first firm that I went to, where myself and Georgia and Andrew were probably like three out of maybe, you know, five black people. You know, by the time I left the city, or in my last few years in the city, there were lots and lots of black and Asian and ethnic minority people working in the city. So in terms of the numbers, I would say that was the definite change. But I didn't see anything, you know, like in the 23 years I worked in the city, I knew of one black sort of senior manager. He wasn't even a board member. He was just below the board. He was a senior manager. And I remember like two Asian senior managers, and I'm talking about 23 years at various different banks. And we talk about, you know, the top banks in the city, you know, five or six of them. I also worked in other spaces as well that weren't banks. And those are only people that I ever saw in the senior positions.
All right, we're in section three now, so a progressive future. And your final track was Hollywood Divorce by Outkast. Any special reason for that?
I love Outkast. I love that they're just so different, especially Andre. Andre, is it 2000 or 3000?
3000. Are you sure?
I know. You know what? You know what it is. When you get to 50, you start to have all this these issues with your memory. Andre, I like his style. He's so eclectic. He's just different, man. He's just like, and so anything Outkast were doing back then, I was into. Again, it sort of shows another side to me. It's almost like a cross between hip hop and soul funk. You know that. Yeah. You know that kind of shows my genres there.
I love that. And I love that you have an eclectic taste in music. I think that's important. So thank you for that. I guess to bring it up to kind of current day, and I guess why we're all so familiar with your name now, is to do with the Black Lives Matter movement. So I hate to go from such, you talking so fondly about music to this question, but I'm going to go to it anyway. Where were you when you first heard about the brutal killing of George Floyd, and what impact did that have on you?
You know what? I can't actually remember where I was when I first heard of it. I think I was out and about, and I'd heard people sending stuff, and I kind of refused to watch it. But then what happened is when I got home, I was at home, and then it was thrusted onto the TV in the news or something, and then I was sort of, I was almost forced to watch it, and then I saw it, and firstly, obviously, I was like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and then that secondly, like a tear sort of ran down. I didn't even realize at the time, but then I realized it came down and went, and I thought, I tasted a tear. I thought, oh my god, you're crying, Pat. Like, I just sort of thought to myself, you know, when is this gonna stop? Like, enough is enough. Like why are we hated so much? And I just started to well up, and I cried. Like, it really, really touched me and really, really affected me. And so that was when I sort of first saw it.
And did that inspire you to get involved in the BLM marches?
Yeah, so I had some friends reach out, and what really inspired us, because I'm not really a person to go to marches and demonstrations. I've been to carnival like about probably two times in my life, and that's because I'm not really a person that likes lots of crowds, you know, like and lots of people. So, when you had the EDL member put out that rant, I don't know if you're aware of that, but he put out a rant to all the football hooligans and English Defence League guys and far rights and whoever else to come down to London to protect the statues, which had already been boarded up. They were all fine and protected already because they'd been boarded up. So really, in essence, they wanted to come down for a tear up or whatever they were looking for. We felt, myself and my friends and I, we felt obligated to go down there because, you know, we had had run-ins with the National Front growing up, the NF, you know, those guys. You know, let's just say they weren't very nice. So we just thought there's no way we're going to let these young protesters, women and children, because there was a lot of children and women protesting. We weren't going to let them face these thugs. So we decided we were going to go down there and try and oversee things and protect those that needed protecting.
And it's interesting because I think the assumption is when you see that picture of you, that you were there as a protester, and you weren't. You were there as a protector.
Yeah. Yeah, wasn't there to protest. You know, the younger generation, it's their time, and I'm happy with them doing all of that. It's the one and only protest I've actually been to. I was just there to oversee and try to make sure harm didn't come to, you know, any of the protests or any of the young people, and to make sure that none of them did anything that they would regret later on. Because a lot of these protesters are students at university, and all it takes is a moment of madness, you know, behaving crazy in their herd mentality, and before you know it, they're in front of the courts and going to prison for something that they don't even realize what's happened, you know. So we wanted to make sure that we were there to, as older, wiser members of the community, to just calm people down, and that's what we were there.
And you know, I think that's admirable, because not everyone would take that sort of stance. I appreciate you for doing that, because not everyone would.
Thank you.
And I think it's interesting, because you became a hero on that fated day. What prompted you to aid Bryn Mael? And were you surprised to learn that he was an ex-police officer?
If I'm honest, not really. I wasn't that surprised. We've been saying for quite some time, us members of the Black community, that the police have been institutionally racist towards us. Here was that mic drop moment when here's an ex-police officer. He's supporting a far-right group. He supports Millwall. You know, unfortunately, Millwall do have some fans, not all of them, but they have lots of fans who do carry certain opinions about Black people or people that are non-white. You know, on top of that, he's an ex-police officer. So it's sort of all, it was almost like that mic drop moment. Like, here you go. We told you so.
Yeah. Was it just your instinct that kicked in? You saw someone in pain and you said, regardless of where they sit on the line, you know, you don't want to see anyone get hurt. Was that the instinct that happened for you then?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, don't get me wrong, I weren't there to protect anybody from the other side, to be honest. I was there to protect the protesters that were marching, you know, for equality, and look after the women and the children and the young men that were there. But I'm not the type of person that's going to stand by and see harm come to anybody when I know that I'm capable of intervening and doing something about it. So, you know, it was just an instinct kicked in. You know, I saw what was happening. I feared for, you know, what might have happened to him, as well as what would have happened to some of the young protesters had they been caught on camera doing things, like I mentioned earlier, that they shouldn't be doing. So I jumped in there instinctively and, you know, pulled him out and carried him to safety.
What I think is so interesting about that story is the fact that your instinct kicked in to help someone on the opposition. I think that's fantastic and admirable. But what I found so, so interesting is that the man has still not said thank you. Now, I'm sure you weren't expecting a thank you, but it's shocking to me just that you wouldn't say thank you to someone for saving you in that moment. Do you still feel surprised by that, or you just, you know, you don't really care, you're over it?
Yeah, I mean, you know what, it's just is what it is. I don't hold any grudge towards the guy. I'm sure he has his reasons. You know, one day, for some reason, I feel like our paths will cross one day, who knows? But like I said, I don't hold no hard feelings, and I didn't do it for the thanks. To be honest, I've got enough notoriety from what happened. It literally turned my life upside down and changed my life. So I'm fine with it. You know, I mean, obviously, I guess the ultimate thanks would be from him.
You know what? I hope the ultimate thanks might be that he's changed his opinion, and he realizes that we're all human together, and that his actions that day were not acceptable or necessary. But as you say, it's changed your life. When did you first hear that you were now, you know, famous? The image was beaming around the world. What was that moment like for you?
I think it was probably like a couple of hours after the fact. I think traveling back from the shenanigans of the day, like on that day, we'd done quite a few things, but my moment was caught on camera. But we were going back, going to get something to eat, having a chat, and then, you know, my phone started going a bit mental. My sister messaged me and said, "Is this you, bruv? It looks like you. Is this you?" And I said, "Oh yeah." Like, she said, "Oh my God, this is on Reuters feed, and it's going viral." it's all over the, it's going all across the world. Like you've gone viral. You're going to be famous. I said, what are you talking about? She said, look, like just check. So I had a look and I could see things were just going mental. I showed it to my friends and then their phones started going mental as well. So at the time I just, I took the video and the picture. She sent me a little video, some footage, and she sent me a picture. I just thought, oh, let me put it on my Instagram. And I put it on my Instagram. And at the time, I thought, what would you write like for a picture like this? It's so, it's such a poignant like moment. And then I said, you know what? I coined a phrase. I said, you know what? It's not black against white. It's everybody versus these racists in my head. And then I kind of wrote that. And then the rest is history. Like, that's my quote now. And yeah. Even my book was named the same thing. You know, it's not black versus white, it's everybody versus racism. You know, we just changed the end of it there. But yeah, that's how that phrase was born.
And I think that's a beautiful sentiment, because that's the reality. That's what we all need to be living by as a sentiment. I know from that moment you went to, and I'm probably jumping a few months ahead here potentially, it might have been days, I'm not even sure. You went from there to Harry and Meghan and speaking to a prince.
That was crazy. Well, like, firstly, so that was to do with GQ. So from the minute that I became well known, GQ have like really championed me. And at the time, Dylan Jones was the editor. I'm not sure if he still is now, editor in chief. But they really, really supported me, and they gave me awards. They just championed everything I did, and they had me on various shoots. I did so much stuff with them, and I'm really thankful. And one of the many things they did was set up the conversation with Prince Harry. And that was sort of done at the Condé Nast up in where the Vogue, you know, Vogue House, as you call it, where, Vogue and GQ are based. And that was, it's obviously something I'll never forget. It was... It was really nice. He's a really nice guy. I mean, someone I always admired anyway, because of his involvement in Invictus Games. I really, really had a soft spot for him in terms of the royals, along with his mother, the Princess Diana, who my mum absolutely adored. And so so it was nice to talk to him, and he was a really nice down to earth chap. And just talking, people ask me, weren't you nervous? And I thought, well, no, he's just I have a son who's 30. 31 this year, and it was like talking to my son. He's just a young man, like it was a really good conversation. And we got to talk off camera a bit as well, so there's stuff we spoke about that wasn't filmed, but yeah, top guy.
And I guess from that point onwards, you've had a catalogue of amazing things happen to you. So Michelle Obama's endorsement of the photo, GQ Humanitarian Award, becoming an author, and I'm sure many, many more. What was for you the highest achievement thus far, and why? I like that you had a deep inhalation there, because I feel like every other question you've been able to just answer it and flow, but now you have to.
I know. It's firstly, when I think back, like all of this happened in the space. I mean, obviously it's been a year since it happened, but all of this stuff we're talking about happened before the end of the year, right? So this happened in June, and within 6 months I'd done all this stuff. So that was the first thing. It was an insane few months. So I'd say the biggest achievement was the book. Becoming an author, I think, was probably my proudest moment and biggest achievement. Outside of obviously have my children and grandchildren, that is, but that would be the big achievement. But the person that had me really going a bit funny was talking to Reverend Al Sharpton, because I know, you know, he's the part he's played in civil rights movement over in America, and to have him say certain things about me. He was saying something about me in a speech, and then Good Morning Britain, Piers and Susanna and co, they got hold of it, and then they decided to have me on. And then they surprised me by having the Reverend on as well. So I didn't know the Reverend was going to be on the call, on the Zoom at the time. And so that was an absolute shock. And so to see him there, live TV, it had me, I was all nervous, and it sort of caught me off guard as well. So that was the moment that really sort of got me, because with the Harry moment, it was all planned and it was all organized and I knew it was happening.
Sure.
But with Reval Sharpton just turning up on the screen like that on live television as well, that was a moment that like, I won't forget as well. And it was it had me like, you know, lump in my throat, feeling all funny.
I love that. You know, you they say never meet your idols, right? But you've actually met someone, yeah. and it was good. You can vouch
for that. Yeah, no, it was amazing. And the stuff that he said about me, that's what the stuff that really got me choked, you know? That was what really, did it for me.
So, Patrick, after 23 years in the city, what advice would you have for other Black professionals who are trying to enhance their career trajectory or climb the career ladder?
I think my advice probably would be more for the industry, so in terms of the corporate world, because I don't think that I can give too much more advice to us as people or as ethnic minority people. We're doing all we need. We're getting ourselves educated, and we're trying to get through the door of these corporates. But I think I would speak more to the corporates, and I think that like the first thing I would say to them is that one of the things that really troubled me is that I wasn't somebody that liked to go out on a Friday and go for a drink. And a number of my Asian colleagues were the same for whatever reasons. Some of them were Muslim and they didn't drink alcohol, etc. But I felt like we were alienated because we didn't want to be part of the clique, you know. And it seemed to me that a lot of the business decisions that were made, you know, were made on that Friday night.
Yeah.
So being working in the office for the 5 days of the week and being involved in meetings probably wasn't enough. It seemed like you had to be involved with these people on a Friday night having a drink to progress or be involved in major decisions. So I think you know, letting people feel alienated would be a major thing. Also, I feel like when you do have a Black person who does manage to make it through the obstacles and gets to somewhere near the top, they're worried about their position at the top, and the last thing they want to do is ruffle any feathers, because they know what it took them to get there, and they feel like they need to sort of, I don't know, be a certain way. But I feel like the companies allowed them to be who they are, and made them feel comfortable in their space, then those people would help other Black people elevate, and they wouldn't be so quick to close the door behind them. Because I feel like, you know, if you do find a Black guy or a Black woman who is, you know, at an exec level, they sometimes close the door behind them, and they don't want to help anybody else come up. And I don't think it's their fault. I think it's the way that they're treated. They're almost, you know, conditioned to behave a certain way. And forget those that have that are behind them trying to get through the door as well. So these companies need to make us feel like we can bring our whole selves to work and be who we are, and also, you know, help others that look like us make it too. I think, you know, something like that is paramount.
I think you're absolutely right. I've delivered training for many of these organizations and for their Black networks and, you know, the ethnic minority networks. And time and time again, I'm having to train them on how to develop their personal brand and compensate for the fact that they're not going to that Friday night drinks or that Thursday night drinks. And so how do you then think of other ways to network and build your profile, credibility, and still be in on the conversation without being in the pub? And that's, you're right, that's such a tough thing to do. And it isn't just on the person, it is on the culture of the organization. I almost feel like being online, all of us being at home on Zoom, has almost leveled that playing field a little bit. Would you agree?
Yeah, I've heard that said numerous times, that you'll find that a lot of people from an ethnic minority background haven't minded this working from home scenario, because it's almost like you're respected more now for what you're producing in a work environment, as opposed to, you know, who you're mates with and who you socialize with. It's all about work now, and there's no socializing because of COVID. There's not been any socializing, so it's almost like you say, it's leveled the playing field for a lot of us.
Is there any tips you would like to give to the audience on how to be a part of social change when it comes to racism and so on? even if you don't want to be an activist or a protester, what can they do to be a part of the change they want to see?
I just think people, I don't really like to put too much pressure on people, because I'm a Libra, and so I look at both sides of the scales, always look at both sides to everything. And sometimes I say to myself, what's it like right now to be a white person? And it can't be easy for people either, because it's like they're scared of saying the wrong things. They might want to, you know, get involved in conversations, but they're scared to say the wrong things because they'll be vilified for saying the wrong thing. So firstly, we got to make sure that we don't shout people down if they do make mistakes. You know, we have to, you know, if we're going to have these uncomfortable conversations, we have to make people feel comfortable, right? So that would be the first thing I would say. Like, don't shout people down. If we want to get true allies, and what's what we want? We want true allies. We don't want people just doing things for argument's sake. We want true allies on side. So therefore, we're going to have to engage with people, hear what they have to say, and sort of see things from their side as well. So that's just my take on things. I don't want anyone to feel that they need to do this or need to do that. I want them to do it because they feel, you know what, I really like Patrick, or I really like Bianca, and I want to support them in their cause or what it is they're trying to do. And they're willing to find out more and learn. And that's kind of what I want. I want genuine, authentic allies, people that are willing to support us, but they do it because they want to, not because they're being told to do it or because they feel it's the right thing to do.
So what's next for you, Patrick?
Yeah, like there are things in the pipeline that I can't talk about. But one thing that I can talk about that I'm working on, like, so obviously there's UKI, United to Change and Inspire. We don't pronounce the T, so it's just UKI. We have four pillars. That's education, criminal justice, mental health and well-being, and youth development. And the pillar that I'm aligned with a lot is the educational stuff. And we're in the process of setting up a alternative educational provision. And that is for children who are not doing so well in mainstream school, being kicked out of mainstream school and thrown into pupil referral units. And there is a correlation between children that go to pupil referral units and then end up becoming young offenders. Mm. Or end up in gangs. So we're trying to break that cycle and stem that flow. And we're trying to give those children an alternative, because, you know, academia, for whatever reason, hasn't worked for those children. Normally, because in the early years, if you don't have the influence from your parents and people around you to get start you off, you know, reading and doing numeracy from an early age, you're behind as soon as you sort of get to, you know, your early teens, etc. So what happens is those children, then they just fall further and further behind, and then they get themselves involved in other stuff. Because let's face it, when you're in the classroom and you don't understand something and you feel dumb, you act up and you play up and you get kicked out. But a lot of these children, I've had experience of working with my coaching as an athletics coach. And I find that they're all talented in so many other areas, but no one bothers to find out what it is. And so in these provisions, we're trying to find out what it is that they're interested in by giving them numerous opportunities. You're going to have to still do bits of maths and English, but we're going to get you to do a lot of this stuff as well. And hopefully we can steer these children into go on to college later on, or just become apprentice somewhere, but just keep them off, you know, that route to becoming young offenders, because we need to do something to stop them. And you know, on a personal note, apart from that, I'm going to be launching a range of VMS products, vitamins, minerals, and supplements. Somebody's obviously seen me as a picture of health, and an upstart, somebody that promotes fitness and health and being 50, and apparently doing it well.
Amazing. So a wellness line as well as an education facility.
Yes.
That's a good balance. Give me a final statement, a pledge for your future intent. What do you want to be known for in terms of your legacy?
Well, I've been going into lots of schools through UKI. Did a couple this week. And, you know, what I leave the children with is firstly, I believe that how to counteract racism is to start with the children. I believe that if we educate the children, then the future will be bright and we'll have a lot less people judging people for the color of their skin. So I feel like some of the older people, they're lost causes, but the children are definitely the way to go. And so I go into schools and we talk about, you know, what happened to me on that day, what I did, why I've become famous, and, you know, why it's not cool to, you know, be a bully or be a racist or discriminate against people. And it's been going down really well with the children. And I like to leave them with, you know, the old Gandhi saying of, you know, if we all be the change we want to see in the world will change overnight. And so that's what I'm championing. I'm just trying to champion everybody trying to be the change they want to see in the world. And we'll try and, because there's so much toxic stuff going on in the world today. And so we need to counteract it with positive energy and positive stuff and positive vibes and, you know, educate our children. And if we do that, I feel like, you know, we'll come out on top eventually.
And that is a beautiful sentiment to end on. Be the change you want to see in the world. I think we could all live by that. Sadly, we've finished. We've run out of time. I could sit and talk to you all day, quite literally. I've got so many more questions I want to ask you. But thank you very much, Patrick, for joining me today and opening up about your fascinating life, your remarkable relationships, and your future aspirations, and just being so open and honest about it. I really do appreciate that. Please join us next time on the BBI's You're On Mute, where we hear from another icon, business leader, or famous personality. Until then, please subscribe, review, and leave your feedback wherever you get your podcasts. If you're a leader and would like to share your journey and opinion on social justice and a fair society, please email us on podcast@blackbusinessinstitute.com. Until next time, goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.